Okay, so you're thinking about buying a business, right? Maybe a cool little coffee shop or a tech startup, something like that.
You got to be careful. It's not always as straightforward as it seems.
Exactly. I mean, what happens if the seller, isn't exactly truthful about how things are going? What if they kind of embellish the the financial picture a bit?
Well, that's exactly what we're diving into today. This idea of fraudulent misrepresentation in contract law, especially when it comes to selling businesses.
And for that, we've got a classic case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Spies v. Brandt, that really lays out the rules of the game.
Right. And for all you law students out there, this is a must-know case. Like, it's a foundational case that really shows you how the law deals with those situations where someone basically gets tricked into buying a business based on false promises.
So we're talking about fraud, right? But it's not like simple theft. It's more about these misleading statements that make something look way more appealing than it actually is.
Yeah, and the key thing here is the reliance. Like, the buyer has to actually rely on those misrepresentations when they make their decision.
So let's set the scene here. It's 1947. We're in Minnesota, and we've got these two brothers, Lowell and Maurice Spies. They're looking to buy a business, Jameson's Wilderness Resort.
And they're dealing with the owners, William and John Carlos Brandt, who've been running the resort for a while.
Now, the Brandts, they paint this really appealing picture of the resort, right? They're telling the Spies brothers, hey, we're making good money here, and you guys can too. You can easily make those payments and then some.
The problem is, it wasn't true at all. The resort was actually losing money year after year.
And the Spieses, they buy it. They put down $10,000, a big chunk of change back then, and agree to pay the rest in installments.
And about 6 months later, bam, they default on a payment. Can't keep up.
And instead of just trying to work it out, they go to court. They say, hey, we were tricked. We were told this place was profitable, and it's not. We want out of this deal.
And that's where it gets really interesting for you as law students. They're asking the court to rescind the contract, basically undo the whole thing because of this fraudulent misrepresentation.
So the big question for the court is, can the Brandts be held responsible for those statements about the resort's profitability, especially when they turned out to be false?
Exactly. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, yeah, they can be. They upheld the trial court's decision to rescind the contract. They said, hey, this was fraud. The Brandts knew or should have known that what they were saying wasn't true. And the Spieses relied on those statements to their detriment.
This case basically sets a precedent, right? It sends a clear message. You can't just go around making false claims about a business to lure in buyers.
Right. And the court even uses this really strong language. They say, one who deceives another to his prejudice ought not to say the victim was negligent in trusting them.
Now, that's pretty powerful stuff. They're basically saying that if you're trying to deceive someone, you can't then blame them for believing you.
Exactly. And that really gets to the heart of the whole idea of reliance and the responsibility of the seller to be honest in these transactions.
So how does the court actually determine if there was fraud? Like, what are the specific things they look at?
Well, they use this thing called the 11-element test for fraudulent misrepresentation. It's a really important framework that helps break down this complex idea of fraud into manageable pieces.
Okay, so let's go through those elements. Give us the rundown.
Sure. First, you got to have a representation. That means the seller has to make some kind of statement, a claim about the business, like saying it's profitable or that it has certain assets. In this case, the Brandt's representation was that the resort was making good money.
Got it. So what's next?
Number two, that representation has to be false, meaning it's not true. In Spies v. Brandt, the resort was actually losing money, so the Brandt's claims were demonstrably false.
Okay, so we've got a false statement about the business. What else?
This is key. It has to be a statement about a past or present fact, so not some prediction about the future or just like an opinion. The court said that the resort's profitability was a present fact, something that could be verified with financial records.
So the brands couldn't just say, oh, we think it'll be profitable in the future. They had to be making a claim about the current state of the business.
Right. Now, the fourth element is materiality. That basically means the false statement has to be about something important, something that would actually influence a buyer's decision.
So in this case, the profitability of the resort was clearly a material fact. Like, who would buy a business if they knew it was losing money?
Exactly. Now, element five is susceptibility of knowledge. This is a fancy way of saying that the truth or falsity of the statement could have been determined. In this case, the financial records would have shown the truth about the resort's profitability.
And this is where the Brandts' refusal to show those records to the Spices becomes really important, right?
Absolutely. It makes it much harder for them to argue that they didn't know or couldn't have known the truth.
So what's element number six?
That's scienter. It's a legal term that means the person making the false statement knew it was false or acted with reckless disregard for the truth. The court inferred that the Brandts had scienter because they refused to hand over those financial records. Like, why else would they hide the numbers?
So they were either deliberately lying or, at the very least, turning a blind eye to the truth.
Right. Now, element seven is intent to induce. This means that the seller made the false statements with the intention of getting the buyer to agree to the deal.
Well, in this case, it's pretty clear that the Brandts' claims about profitability were meant to convince the Spices to buy the resort.
Exactly. And that brings us to element eight, justifiable reliance. This one is a little more nuanced. It means that the buyer's reliance on the false statements has to be reasonable under the circumstances.
So, even though the Spices could have, in theory, pushed harder to see those financial records, the court said their reliance on the Brandts' statements was still justified.
Right. The Brandts were actively hindering the Spices' ability to investigate, so it was understandable that they'd take the sellers at their word, especially considering their own lack of experience in running a resort.
Okay, so what are the last three elements?
Well, number nine is actual reliance. The buyer has to actually rely on the false statements when making their decision. The Spices testified that the profitability claims were a major factor in their decision to buy the resort.
So they were directly influenced by those claims. What about the 10th element?
That's damages. The buyer has to have suffered some kind of harm as a result of the fraudulent misrepresentation. In this case, the Spices were out the money they had already paid, plus whatever other expenses they incurred.
Makes sense. So the final element.
Yeah, causation. There has to be a direct link between the false statements and the buyer's damages. The court found that the Brandts' misrepresentations directly caused the Spices' financial losses.
So there you have it. 11 elements that, when proven, establish fraudulent misrepresentation. But like you mentioned earlier, there were dissenting opinions in this case, right? Not everyone on the court agreed with the majority decision.
Right. Justice Peterson dissented, arguing that the Spices had actually made an initial offer of $90,000 before the Brandts even made those claims about profitability. He suggested that the final price of $95,000 wasn't that much higher, implying that maybe the misrepresentations didn't really influence the Spices all that much.
So he's basically saying, hey, they were already willing to pay close to the final price anyway, so maybe the fraud wasn't as big of a deal as the majority opinion makes it out to be.
Yeah, that's his perspective. He also thought the court was giving the Spices too much of a pass because of their youth and inexperience. He felt that regardless of their age, they should have been more diligent in their investigation.
What about the other dissenting opinion?
Justice Gallagher had a couple of interesting points. First, he noted that expert testimony valued the resort property itself at over $100,000. Meaning that the sale price of $95,000 might have actually been a bargain, even with the alleged misrepresentations.
So he's saying the Spices weren't actually overpaying, which weakens the argument that they were tricked into a bad deal.
Right. And then he also argued that the Brandts' statements about future profits were just opinions, not statements of fact. Like, they were saying things like, you guys can make good money here too, which is kind of vague and speculative.
So according to Justice Gallagher, those statements shouldn't be treated the same as a concrete claim about the resort's current financial performance.
Exactly. He also pointed to the fact that the Spices did actually make some rental income in 1948 after they took over the resort. He suggested that their ultimate business failure might have been due to their own poor management, not just the Brandts' initial statements.
So the dissenters are raising some valid points. They're basically saying, hold on, maybe the buyers share some responsibility here. Maybe they should have done more research, and maybe we shouldn't punish the sellers too harshly for making some optimistic statements.
It's a good reminder for you, you know, that the law is often about balancing different interests. In this case, it's about balancing the buyer's right to rely on a seller's representations with the seller's right to make some optimistic statements without fearing that they'll be sued for fraud if things don't work out perfectly.
So what are the big takeaways for our listeners, especially those of you who are studying law or thinking about going into business?
First, Spies v. Brandt really highlights the importance of documentation. Get everything in writing. If you ask for financial records and the seller refuses, make a note of that. if they make any verbal promises, get it confirmed in email, or even better, in the contract itself.
That documentation can be crucial if you ever need to prove that misrepresentations were made.
Huh.
What else?
Be really careful about the distinction between factual statements and opinions. If a seller makes a concrete claim about a business's current performance, that's different from them just saying, I think you could do really well with this.
If something seems too good to be true, it probably is. Don't let your excitement cloud your judgment. Do your due diligence, ask tough questions, and don't be afraid to walk away from a deal if something doesn't feel right.
Right. Remember, you're the one who's taking on the risk, so you need to be absolutely sure that you're making an informed decision.
So to wrap things up, here's a question for you to ponder as you continue your legal studies. Should the law place more emphasis on a buyer's responsibility to investigate and uncover any potential issues? Or should it prioritize a seller's duty to be honest and transparent, even if the buyer could have maybe discovered the truth on their own? It's a complex issue with no easy answers.
And as you come across other cases and hypothetical scenarios, I encourage you to apply that 11-element test for fraudulent misrepresentation. It's a powerful tool for analyzing these situations and really understanding the nuances of what constitutes fraud in a legal context.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Spies v. Brandt. It's a case that's both fascinating and relevant, and it offers some important lessons for anyone who's ever bought or sold a business or who's just interested in the complexities of contract law.
Absolutely. It's a classic case for a reason, and it's one that you'll likely encounter again and again throughout your legal career. So make sure you really understand its implications and how it can be applied in different situations.
All right, that's it for today. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.
Until then, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep exploring the fascinating world of the law.